You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. Every listener matters, and we're here because of listeners like you. Thank you for all your support.
Segment of our show is a post-dated one, so some of the events referred to may already have happened. In this segment of our show, Abby Bierman will be telling us a little bit about the Trauma Survivors Network. So if you could introduce yourself and tell me a little bit about the network, that'd be great.
Sure. So my name's Abby Bierman. I'm the National TSN Coordinator, or Trauma Survivors Network. The Trauma Survivors Network is a program of the American Trauma Society. It was developed in 2008 as a way to connect survivors and really build a community for those recovering from physical injury. Our network is not only in the U.S., but we also have a site in Canada and Australia. And our national programs are open to anyone, no matter where they reside. And all of our programs are focused on helping survivors of physical injury as well as their loved ones throughout the recovery journey, no matter if they're days out from their injury or decades.
So, that being said, does any of your work focus on the mental health aspect of recovery?
Yes. So, one of the reasons the TSN was created was the American Trauma Society and trauma care in general saw that while clinical practices were improving, long-term outcomes for patients weren't. And one of the reasons is they were so focused on the physical recovery that they weren't caring for the social and emotional aspects of recovery for survivors. And injuries of survivors of injury, as well as their loved ones, are at increased risk for anxiety, PTSD, depression, the symptoms thereof. And building community and connection and supports as early in the recovery journey as possible can help mitigate those risks and create a more resilient mental health.
So how does the network reach out to those who could potentially benefit?
So the network, we're composed of over 300 programs. Most of them are at trauma centers and rehab hospitals. So they're able to get that information into patients' hands early in the recovery journey because they're the ones treating them. We also have a lot of resources that go out to the general community. We have a lot of partners that we advertise through, just trying to reach the individuals who would best be supported by our services. And everything the Trauma Survivors Network provides is at no cost to the patients and families.
So, in your efforts, do you ever encounter any myths or stereotypes concerning trauma?
All the time. One of the things I hear a lot is that people think that their struggles are... Let me think of the best way to phrase this. So everyone's recovery journey is unique, but there are a lot of commonalities that survivors will experience. And unfortunately, people feel so alone and isolated during recovery that they think their experience no one else would understand. And that's not true. Once someone is able to connect with another survivor, they realize that the things they thought no one would understand are actually a commonality that brings them together as a survivor community. And the other myth we see kind of outside of the survivor community is this myth that recovery ends at discharge from the hospital. And anyone who has been injured or has a loved one who has been injured knows that discharge is the start of the recovery journey. That's not the end. It really goes for weeks, months, years afterwards. And there's some individuals who feel like they never finish the recovery journey, and they're just adapting to a new reality.
So in your time with the network, is there any success moment or story that stands out for you you'd like to share?
Oh, this is a hard one to narrow down. I think the success moments are really getting to talk with the survivors and loved ones. And that moment they realize they're not alone, that they have found a community who understands and supports them and helps them grow and thrive. Meeting the survivors who talk about this being like a family, how they wish injury on no one, but it's the best family they've ever found. The people who say they feel heard for the first time, that these supports are making such a difference for their lives. And that's what I love hearing. I don't want people to feel like they're alone, that they're isolated, that they have to go through recovery by themselves. I love the moments when they feel heard, when they feel seen, and when they feel connected.
So do you ever find that when someone who's been through a trauma finds a focal point, a reason, if you will, to sort of reclaim their life, that gives them an added strength?
Yeah, so there's a lot of people who find a new purpose almost after their injury, or there's some aspect of their health that really drives them in their recovery. So, and it's different for everyone. I've talked to survivors who talk about how they really focused on the physical aspect, that they were really into sports or activity, and their entire recovery journey and their healing from trauma was really driven by getting back out there and participating in the sports they loved, even if it was using adaptive equipment. I've talked to others who really saw their kind of new focal point, as you put it, of recovery as a new purpose of giving back to others, connecting with other survivors, being there as a peer mentor, a peer visitor, someone to really provide guidance to others early in the recovery journey. Others have gotten really involved with advocacy. They don't want anyone else to be injured in the same way they were or to not have the same supports available to them, so they get really involved with advocacy. Now, we have quite a few survivors who have gone on to start their own nonprofits around specific work that they're passionate about.
Like, thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Of course.
In this segment of our show, Linda Milanese will be telling us about ADW. So what can you tell me about assistance dogs?
So Assistance Dogs of the West was founded in 1995 by Jill Felice with one dog and one person. She went to Bergen University, which is a service dog training university, to learn how to train canines to become professionals to help people with a variety of disabilities. We kind of look at our professional canines in two ways: the one dog, one person, which we've expanded to include all different kinds of disabilities, veterans from all different combats, medical alert dogs for diabetes and for seizure response, and anything that would provide greater independence for an individual. One dog, one person. In 2010, we started to hear that canines were being used in the investigation and prosecution of crime. And so we started to place dogs in district attorney's offices, child advocacy centers, domestic violence shelters, anywhere where a professional in a special victim advocacy role could utilize a canine in order to provide support for us. They call them special victims because generally they're children or people with disabilities or elders. And so these dogs are actually trained to do forensic interviews, deposition hearings, SANE exams, which are sexual assault exams, and to go into the witness box with the witness and actually sit in the witness box during a trial and provide support.
So
a few years, go ahead.
So I'm thinking, especially for a child or someone with a mental health concern, having a canine companion there in a justice setting would tend to have an enormous soothing impact.
It has an enormous soothing impact, and there's a lot of science behind that. And so because we've been with dogs for 30,000 years or so, just looking at a dog at rest lowers your heart rate, lowers your blood pressure, lowers your cortisol level, and increases your oxytocin, which is, that is your social bonding hormone. And so all of that contributes to being able to make your way through the judicial process, which is kind of a grisly affair, especially if you're a child. I mean, you think about a courtroom and you have, you know, the prosecutor who is representing the child, and you have the defense attorney where the perpetrator is sitting and the child is in the witness box in front of the person that perpetrated the crime. And so this has been a super, super successful utilizing the canines in this way. A few years later, we were contacted by the FBI, and we were asked whether we could place dogs that would be on a rapid deployment team out of victim services for mass violence incidents. And so that is like the Las Vegas concert shooting, Uvalde, Pulse nightclub, these situations that happen where there are many people involved. And so in 2013, we placed the first crisis response canines at headquarters in Washington, D.C. And those two dogs, one, Giovanni, Gio, he retired last year, and Wally retired in July of this year. We still have, we placed dogs in Dallas field office and Atlanta field office last year, and we're placing another one in Seattle in the very near future. And so this was the genesis of crisis response canines. So some of our placements at district attorney's offices include crisis response canines. So when a mass violence incident occurs, teams of dogs and handlers from various areas meet, and what happens is a family assistance center is established. This is nothing you'll ever see on TV, but it's a consortium of professionals that work behind the scenes to give victim services. So it's the Red Cross, it's trauma-informed counselors, it's the crisis response canines with, you know, professionals in the investigation and prosecution of crime, and other professionals that provide services. So for instance, with Uvalde, they did 33 forensic interviews with the children, and they helped 800 family members and community members during that deployment.
So curious, do you find that having that sort of soothing presence in the initial phases can help long term? I mean, if a child, for example, is calmed at sort of the inception of the trauma, might having the dog there at that time make it easier as they transition going forward?
Well, you know, I'm not a mental health professional, so that's kind of a hard question for me to really give you science-based answer. But I do know that in victim advocacy, when the case is handled, almost all of the people who have a dog that works with a special victim, they have little stuffies of the dog that has, you know, has a badge from that district attorney's office, or has a vest that has the dog's name with the Child Advocacy Center, and the children get to take those stuffed animals home as a remembrance of their time with the canine. So, you know, I would venture a guess that would say yes. Remember that sometimes, you know, the process is not linear. It could move along into mediation rather quickly, or it could go for 3 to 5 years before it ever comes to trial. And so that special victim advocate and that dog is the singular presence that remains the same throughout the proceedings.
So in your time with assistance dogs, is there any success moment or story that stands out for you you'd like to share?
Well, you know, that's a really interesting question. I have the privilege of holding a space for a little more hope in the world. And so I don't know that I could really tell you that there is one specific moment, except we did receive, I mean, this was a very thrilling moment. We did receive an award from the FBI, a community service award. They are given to, it was actually 56 people from every state in the United States. And a couple had two from one state. And that was at headquarters. And former director Christopher Ray was the director at the time. And that was truly a thrilling moment. We also received a local award from our Albuquerque FBI office in tandem with that national award. So I have to say that those were really moments that are standout. But every day we get to hold that space, and that's, in my world, that's a pretty privileged place to be.
Like to thank you for taking time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great. Andy Lank will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
If you could save a life one day, would you? In Ontario, there are over 1,600 people waiting for a life-saving organ transplant right now. Every 3 days, one of these people will die while waiting. By taking just 2 minutes to register as an organ donor, you can save up to 8 lives and transform 75 more through tissue donation. What you decide to do today has the power to make a lasting impact. Join millions of other registered organ donors in Ontario and give hope to those waiting. Register at beadonor.ca.
Welcome back to HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, Abby Bierman told us a little bit about the Trauma Survivors Network, and we heard about ADW from Linda Melanesi. In this segment of our show, John Sutherland will be telling us about adaptive bodywork. So what can you tell me about bodywork?
What can I tell you about bodywork in general or adaptive bodywork specifically?
Adaptive.
Well, adaptive bodywork looks at the body as a system rather than looking at it as pieces and that reductionist typical view that most people hone into something. We're always working as the system, as a complete organism. So typically you'll get people who will present with a certain complaint. They have a sore back or a sore neck or something. And I listen to all their complaints because this is what they're coming to you for. But typically those are artifacts of a global imbalance. So the way I approach the system is always globally from head to foot. I want to activate the whole body more than I want to focus on any particular symptom, which is more likely a victim of some imbalance.
So in that sense, what are some of the key differences between the adapted version of body work and the able-bodied equivalent?
Compared to what?
The adaptive version versus non-adaptive.
You mean like a massage, for example?
Yeah.
Well, the most popular form of bodywork is Swedish massage. And this, by nature, it's what we call a palliative model. So it's designed to give your central nervous system some ease, some relaxation. You'll feel good. But it's not a structural modality. So you're not changing anything sustainably in the body. You're just oiling the body and sliding over the surface and making it feel good. And there's a series of different strokes you can do, and everyone likes the feeling. But this was actually the first thing I studied. I did a certification of Swedish massage. And the problem I had was I was an athlete and all my peers were athletes. And my big question to my teachers was, how am I going to sell this? Because my peers weren't interested in temporarily feeling good if I couldn't demonstrate to them that there was some clear advantage, performance or otherwise. They had better things to do with their time.
So what are some of the long-term benefits of things like massage therapy and whatnot?
Well, massage therapy, I mean, everyone is subjected to a variety of stressors. You know, work, emotional, physiological, it's biomechanical, through repetition, from overuse, from age. Everything stresses our body. And all forms of massage will give you some relief of different degrees, of different durations. But even that human connection is always a beneficial thing. So I think that every form of massage has its utility and its place. But what distinguishes adaptive bodywork from Swedish massage is that it's from the lineage of structural integration, which was developed by Ida Rolf in the end of the 60s. And that typically would work in myofascial continuums throughout the body, from head to toe and from superficial to deep, and through a trajectory of somewhere between 12 and 10 sessions, you would cover the body at various depths, but you would make a substantial change that would modify the way the person holds themselves, perceives themselves, and, you know, moves in society.
So the benefits would include both sort of mental health component as well as physically feeling better, which integrated would seem to present just a better opportunity to perform at one's best in life.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the two aspects, physiological and psychological, are two sides of the same coin. So one thing you invariably notice is that when you modify someone's body, you know, they're standing better, they're a little less inflection, they feel more upright, their gait may be better, their range of motion is probably improved. But more importantly is that these people usually finish with a smile on their face. They feel empowered, embodied, and more optimistic.
So in your time doing this work, is there any success moment or story that stands out for you you'd like to share?
Particular success stories? I mean, practically everyone I work on is a success story to some degree. But I've had situations where clients who began a series with me, I had one woman who completed a series of 12 sessions. She enjoyed the work. You know, at a certain time during the process, she had an emotional release, and this is something that's not atypical of this type of deep structural work, is that something shifts in the body and there's some kind of inner change that happens. And what is interesting about this particular woman I'm thinking about right now is that after we finished our series, she moved from Montreal to Vancouver Island. And I guess a couple of months afterwards, she contacted me and she says that the work we did together allowed her somehow to quit a job that she wasn't happy with, to move to a place she wanted to move to start the business she wanted to start. And she said that was due to the work we did together. So something in that work stirred up something that maybe she knew she needed, but somehow the inertia of her situation was holding her captive. The work mobilized something that allowed her to express who she really was.
I thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure.
My friends, you might call trauma the great divide of disability, for it's both what you can and what you cannot see. Truth is, we can never know the psychological or emotional impact that a traumatic experience fully has on a person. Sometimes, years later, a trigger might just rear its head. People see the result. They see the withdrawal or the anger or what have you. They don't necessarily look beyond the surface and ask the question of, what prompted this? Why is this person acting this way? When in fact, the real question might be, why is this person feeling this way? People need to understand that actions have depth. They can have deep results. It isn't just a matter of a person's body being injured. Sometimes it can be the mind, or even the heart. People are very complex in this sense. One thing tends to interplay with another, and recognizing that there is a holistic need to support trauma survivors is absolutely the right approach. I will concede it takes a deep thinker to ask the question of why a person is dealing with what they're dealing with. Yeah, sometimes it's easier to slough it off and just say, yeah, I don't want to be around this person if they're going to be this way. But if it's someone you care about who is suffering and is having issues with the scars that are below the surface, it's incumbent upon each one of us to show a little patience, show a little decency, to bear with them, to be there as they deal with what they're dealing with. Yeah, there are things that may trigger a person. That's anyone. But doesn't make them a bad person, it doesn't make them an unstable person. It simply means they are a person who has dealt with a lot of things. And how can we show compassion for someone with an obvious physical injury and look around and say, oh, what's inside of you and it's affecting you just as much doesn't matter? As the body heals, there's a good chance the mind will at least have a lessened shock, a lessened trauma from whatever it was that prompted it. But that doesn't mean the effect is ever 100% gone. And recognizing this, we can start to live at our best selves, understanding what triggers us, what will support us in our recovery, and what might be a detriment to that. Recognizing what helps you to live at your best will be a key facet in any recovery, because those who have faced trauma are no different than anyone else in society. They simply want to live at their best. They simply want to understand that they're in a safe environment in which they can grow and prosper. This has been Handy Link. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal, so get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, Burnaby. We are rooted in community support and engagement. Thank you for helping us stay on air.
Cheese, please, yes. Cheese, please, you're so fine.
You want to listen all the time. Snarf, Dude, and Daffodil will spin their hits. It's all cheesy music. They love it to bits. Well, Snarf, Dude is the man in the band. Finding cheesy music.